Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the UK Labour-led government's Africa policy. I'm joined by a very special guest, Mr. Harry Bont. Harry is the Vice President of UK Creswell Strategy, and I think Harry is also a PhD candidate in one of the UK investors there. So Harry, you've built a reputation as a trusted advisor to governments and CEOs on African issues. I look forward to a very exciting conversation like this.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Brilliant. Let me start off. So Labour has recently won a landslide election victory. So although it's still a new government, I think under 100 days in power, do you know if it has an African policy, or if you know, or if it has in its manifesto or anything like that?
So Labour were the only party that had any sort of substantive reference to Africa in their election manifesto. They talked about resetting relationships with the continent, David Lammy, who's the foreign minister, I heard him speak in the run-up to the election where he was talking about how the Foreign Office in the UK still look at Africa through an antiquated and old-fashioned lens, where they see Africa as almost as a problem that needs to be solved through aid and through development assistance, rather than the huge opportunity that the continent offers in terms of economic growth, in terms of partnerships to solve the problems that are facing us all, whether it's climate change, whether it's migration. I think the Labour Party are hopefully at least saying that they're going to reassess relationships with the continent and see it, you know, as 54 different countries rather than one amalgamous, you know, one giant, one country, which is, I think, has been the view in the past. Obviously, Africa is diverse and rich in diversity, and all different countries offer different opportunities. And different ways that the UK can partner with them. So I'm very hopeful that they look at it through a sort of transactional relationship where the UK government sees what they can get from Africa and African governments can see what they can get from the UK. And they approach it like that rather than using that sort of condescending approach where they come to Africa and they feel like they have to lecture African leaders about democracy, about human rights. I think the second you start any relationship with a criticism, yeah, you instantly create bad feeling and bad blood and ill will. Now that's not good. That's going to sort of hold back those meaningful relationships being built, which is what I hope happens in this under this administration.
Brilliant. In previous episode, I interviewed the first secretary to the United States Embassy in London, and he was talking about the US policy and talking about the language as well, the language of seeing Africans as partners rather than what is in the past. But you said, you used the word in your stuff, you said resetting relationship. And then you went on to expatiate on the kind of relationship that is there in the past. So in the last 14 years, I think, with the Tory government, conservative government, what sort of relationship did they have with Africa? Did they have any, was there any coherent African policy? What kind of relationship was that?
Well, I think I can't remember how many African ministers they had, but I think they almost changed it every year. That speaks to a wider instability within those different administrations under Conservative rule. But I certainly think there was an absence of any coherent Africa strategy. Now, I'm under no illusion that that Africa is going to be high on the UK agenda. You know, I would like it to be, but in reality, you know, we've got riots in the streets. We've got an economy that hasn't had sustained economic growth for 14 years. We've got the need to cut public expenditure to get our books balanced again. And so public services is going to be a massive issue for the government. And so, you know, I don't think that Africa is going to be right at the top of the agenda. But I do hope that there are strong, powerful voices within government who have a passion for the continent, who see, you know, the global south as, you know, as a huge opportunity area for the UK and for the West. So hopefully they will be able to lobby the government to actually come up with some sort of coherent long-term plan that moves us to being, you know, the trusted partner on a sort of on an equal footing with African governments. Because I think, as you see, you know, Russia, the way that Russian president treats African presidents, you know, when he has them over in Moscow, the red carpet is literally rolled out for them. They are treated with the respect that they deserve being a head of state from another country. And that builds up goodwill in the same way that Chinese investment on the continent, massive goodwill. You know, the supermarket that we all use here in Kigali, the one that has everything, it's all Chinese. It's all Chinese made. And I can't tell you the amount of goodwill it builds up when people can buy, you know, affordable goods from all around the world because the country has decided to invest real dollars in a market. Mm. It builds up that capital, which then countries can then, you know, withdraw when it comes to trade deals or when it comes to deals over resources.
I'll come to that, the geopolitics and the difference in the West and, you know, the East Africa Russia kind of relationship. And I'll come to that in a minute. But you mentioned something very, very clearly in terms of the direction that the UK Africa policy might take, in terms of like how Africa in terms of what is going on in the globe. You talk about Ukraine, you talk about, you know, what's going on in Palestine and what priority might Africa receive. But then again, and then you talk about the riots on the street here. But how about indirectly? It still ties down to you can't remove Africa from that equation. If you talk about, you know, Rwanda, where you're based right now, talk about the failed, the UK Labour government has, on the first day you take it, is squashed, into the UK Rwanda migration deal. Even on the streets, the singular most polarizing issue in the UK is immigration or migration. So, how do you resolve that? How do you reconcile that? Whilst Africa can be at the background, but yet Africa still features in the singular most, you know, contentious issue in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one of the greatest challenges that the West faces is how do we address the increasing desire for people to move from the global south to the global north? You know, what can we do one of the things that we're missing from the discussion about the UK Rwanda migration partnership, I understand it's controversial, and I understand from a UK perspective that lots of people, particularly on the left of politics, didn't like it because they thought it was punitive. They thought it was endangering the lives of vulnerable people. And whether you agree with that or not, what the partnership did seek to do as well is add the economic development part of the equation. So it's one thing to have a deterrent, and people believe that we should have some sort of active deterrent to stop people from making these really dangerous trips and risking their lives. But we also have to have the economic development part of it. So the UK, there was a lot of coverage about the amount of money the UK was investing in Rwanda, and that was to stimulate economic development in Rwanda. And Rwanda hoped that would be a model which would then be adopted by other Western countries, where they do partnerships with these countries in the global south. And the partnership also involves huge amounts of economic investment here. We have to unlock the human capital on the continent. We have to invest in the infrastructure, which enables companies to outsource from the West to Africa. I have, like, it's one of the most underutilized opportunities, I think, is outsourcing on the continent. You know, I don't have to tell you, but the entrepreneurial attitude, particularly in Nigeria, but all across the continent, it's just not being maximized to the benefit of those countries, or these countries on the continent, but also to the West. And that's because we don't have the infrastructure here. We do in Rwanda, which is a blessing, and one of the reasons why I'm here is because it has that infrastructure which allows you to run an international organization, an international business from here. But lots of other countries don't boast that sort of infrastructure. So in the West, we have to get serious about actually investing in these countries. We have to get businesses over that mental block which they have about the continent, where they see it through a prism which maybe never really existed, but certainly is at least 30 or 40 years out of date. It's that that comic relief. You know, there's wars everywhere, and you can't live good lives here, which is that obviously absolute nonsense. We need to encourage our business leaders in the West to get over that, like I said, that psychological block, to actually start investing in the continent. And that's only going to be the only way that you stop the influx of people from the global south to the global north. We also have to mitigate, obviously, against the effects of climate change, which is a problem created in the West, but it is causing untold suffering, in Africa. And also, when it comes to that conversation, the hypocritical language used by Western countries when they talk about how African countries shouldn't extract the oil under their ground, they shouldn't extract the minerals under their ground, when they've allowed to get, they've got, the West got fat and rich of taking up, all of their resources and taking resources from the continent as well. But now, because climate change is obviously top of the political agenda, it's now up to the countries which haven't benefited from this development to not develop in the same way. It's completely hypocritical.
Yeah, you've mentioned so many interesting things. I'll come back to the double standards in that. But one thing I want to address immediately is, like, in 2020, I think the UK, there was the UK first UK Africa Investment Summit in the UK, and that kind of like looks like a signal, a shift towards what you're talking about is important in terms of like economic investment in trade. And then you see the UK signing MOU with Sierra Leone, and also in terms of like sparking of this kind of like investment. They've talked about having British businesses in Egypt and some African countries like that. But there was supposed to be a second summit, which was supposed to take place in April of this year. I think that had been postponed. Do you think that is going to be continued with the Labour government? Do you think that is going to be the new direction?
I mean, you have to decide on whether these summits are worth the effort and time. I also think it's ridiculous that we are having a UK Africa Investment Summit in London, not in one of the 54 countries on the continent. Here in Rwanda, it's the second most popular destination for events in Africa. And so countries like Rwanda, countries like South Africa, a whole host of other countries are more than capable of hosting these premier events. And also it is forcing businesses to actually get on a plane and come and see it for themselves, because that's one of the problems is the reality on the ground is nothing like the myth in the media and the myth in movies, Western movies, where all you see is war, where all you see is poverty. You come here and you see the buzzing nightlife. You see the fancy restaurants where you can eat the best sort of food, Michelin star style food. And once businesses see it, and they're like, oh my God, it's not this really terrifying place like Portland. And you're like, yes, we've been trying to tell you that. But until you get on a plane and get over here, you're never going to believe it. So the UK government should be getting people on planes. They should be taking them to the continent. They should be using their influence over British businesses to actually get them, to come and see this market for what is, sorry, these markets for what they are. And only then are you going to get people to take that next step and actually think about investing there. Because I think one of the things is people look at investment opportunities through a sort of purely economic and return on investment. But in reality, people want to know that countries are safe for their staff. They want to know that there's local employees who are skilled, that can be recruited for these companies. They want to know their money is safe here, that their money can be withdrawn when they want it to be. And all these things are only overcome when you actually see it for yourself and you see the talent on the ground and you see the infrastructure that's here. That's going to be the way that you get them to overcome these mental obstacles.
You remind me of a recent event that happened. It was a female American comedian that had gone to Zimbabwe for the first time. And then she's like, oh, they've got a supermarket here. And she was surprised that they have, you know, just what you've just said, that they have a Boston life. And, you know, and then she was saying, oh, I'm ignorant. You know, the what they've been fed with the media is like, oh, this is full of poverty, full of... and I do agree with you on... because I've been to several conferences in Europe. There's the biggest African conference in Europe that happens every other year. And it's happened in European soil. And I used to feel like, why is it not happening in Africa? It should be happening in Africa. And but one thing you mentioned is this summit. And I think, again, I don't know if you agree with this. We've seen, I think it's part of the geopolitical competition. So we've seen African leaders going to China-Africa summits. We've seen during the Obama administration, US, African, we've seen in Russia. Do you think this is just politics? There's no, you know, genuinity in this.
Well, I think they work when they are backed up by actual investment. And you know, I can't argue that that Russia and China, but also it's not talked about enough, but Turkish investment in Africa is surging. And it's not just investment in infrastructure, in roads and, you know, in government buildings, in sports stadiums. They've just, if you can see out the window out behind me, you probably can't. There's the new Amahoro Stadium, which is I think one of the largest football stadiums on the continent, here in Kigali. And it's 45,000 seater, and it's all FIFA approved, and that's partly funded by Turkish money, because they see the value in investing in things that's going to stimulate that sense of pride in the continent, that sense that the continent, you know, is moving in the right direction. And Turkey have also opened up huge amounts of embassies across Africa, so you're building up that diplomatic capital, those diplomatic channels that are going to ensure that these events turn from being just, what I would say, a talking shop where people get together and everyone feels good and then no deals are done and people go away, to actually meaning that, yeah, that things are tangible, they're real, that they lead to deals being done, not just MOUs being signed, because anyone can sign an MOU. A memorandum of understanding, which is often used because people don't want to take that next step and actually commit to capital investment in other markets. So they'll sign an MOU, they can sign a piece of paper, it looks good on camera, but in reality, it doesn't actually, the things actually being built. Whereas, you know, much smaller events, and there's a few organizations that work on bringing British investors over for smaller summits in a particular country or a particular region, like the West African Anglophone region, because those markets have similarities, more similarities. So they bring investors over and they have substantive discussions rather than just sort of photo calls and and nice big pictures for everyone to feel good about themselves. So events can be part of it, but they have to have that additional follow up, which is going to lead to things actually happening.
It's quite amazing. Like we've seen, I feel that this to be a very strong paradigmatic shift. So if we look at what's going on in the Sahel and see how France and the US, they seem to have taken the biggest flack in the Sahel. But I think it's quite representative of the Western approach. It's kind of like a repudiation of the Western approach to like how development of issues has been done in Africa. And then, like you rightly said, we've seen Turkey, we've seen UAE, we've seen these middle kind of like powers, taking over. But what I want to say, why is it, do you think the UK, like in the Sahel, for instance, did the UK escape? How did the UK escape that? Because the UK has a substantial level of investment or whatever in the Sahel as well.
In all honesty, I don't actually know how much money the UK has invested in those countries. But clearly, obviously, because of the historical connection, you know, it's the French. It's a reaction to what is seen as the legacy of colonialism in that part of Africa, where those people felt economically tied to the French, to France, in a way that those populations didn't want to continue any longer. But I also think it's It forces countries in the West to decide, you know, how do we want to do business on the continent? Do we want to withdraw our diplomatic relationships? Do we want to withdraw investment and exclude and isolate these countries because they've chosen a different form of government? Some might say it was forced upon them by the military. But I think seeing the reaction on the ground, it felt like there was at least some degree of popular support for what has happened in the countries that have had coups recently. And you look at Senegal, where they obviously haven't had a coup, but they've had a similar political awakening, but through the ballot box this time, where a new generation of leaders have come into power with a clear sort of nationalist mandate, where they want to ensure that any international deals that are being done by international companies in the country firstly benefit Senegalese first and foremost. They were saying that they were going to review all the big deals that have done recently with international companies to make sure that it actually does benefit Senegal as a whole, rather than just an elite group at the top and the foreign investors. So we have to work out: do we want to come to these countries with a sort of a judgmental approach, which is one way of doing foreign policy, or do we want to be much more pragmatic? Work with the people that are in power at the time without publicly chastising them for who they are and for what they're doing. Because at the end of the day, the countries are going to choose their own path, and they've got plenty of other partners around the world who aren't going to apply that human rights lens. So we have to decide, do we want to be left out because we are putting values before value, if you like? Or do we want to put aside our own personal views about human rights, about democracy, and just get on with doing business and helping to stimulate development on the continent, which will ultimately benefit the West, as all the ways we were saying before when it comes to migration, and also when it comes to global economic growth. Africa is the future. What, 70% of sub-Saharan Africans are under the age of 30, something like that, which is, it's insane. It is where future economic growth is going to be driven. And certainly the eastern part of the world are seeing that, and they're investing here without any strings attached.
You captured the very question I was going to ask, Ines. Like clearly, in the next very few years in this century, that there've been statistics saying Africa is going to, the population is going to double, and Africa has like the world's youngest population. So if you look that in parallel to the aging population in Europe, for instance, and look at what implication that has for labor. I mean in terms of like workers, critical workers. In the UK, we've seen, even in the midst, the paradox, even in the midst of the anti-immigration or anti-migrants kind of like sentiment, we've seen there's a massive gap. There's a shortage. There's labor shortage in critical sectors. So how do you think the UK government is going to respond to this paradox where they need critical workers and then amidst this anti-immigration sentiments and trends?
Yeah, and that's the challenge, isn't it? The challenge is that everybody in the UK, everybody in the business world in the UK understands that migration is essential to providing the workforce that we need to grow the economy. And so we've got a government who is promising lower migration, but economic growth. Now, I don't know a formula that is going to allow that to deliver. For those both elements to be delivered. Perhaps there is, the Labour Party are going to find a way of delivering that. But in reality, migration is. It's an essential part of the modern world and modern economies. But I do think that the outsourcing part of this equation is something that could certainly help to marry those two objectives. In that, if we financially incentivize British companies to invest in outsourcing certain jobs, the jobs that maybe can't be filled. To some degree, or can be filled in the UK, but they are lower skilled jobs. If they can be outsourced for good wages to the continent, then you might encourage the people that might be thinking about making the awful journey to not make that journey, because they can sit at their computer and they can do the work that they would do in the UK, but without having to take those risks, and we're still being around their friends and family. You know, just because people are moving to the UK doesn't mean that they actually really want to be there. You know, they want the economic benefit of being there, but they still want to live in the countries where they're from. They want to live amongst their families. They want to eat the food that they're used to eating. But there's just not those opportunities, because we've hoovered up all of the financial power in the West, and then we are not taking the actions to share it reasonably with, you know, with the countries where, you know, that haven't had the benefits of the industrialization like we did.
You kind of, I like the way you've put it. It's quite succinct. And if those opportunities were there, I'm not sure that people really, really want to be here, because I've seen people say, you know, when you leave family behind and come, it's a huge sacrifice. And a lot of times we don't see it from that perspective. We see it from the perspective of people who are just coming, but there are the sacrifices they've made to come. And it's just purely economic opportunities. So if those economic opportunities can be provided, whether they won't be making such sometimes dangerous journeys. But there's another important stuff. So from 2015, when they had Brexit, so the EU-UK government or relationship also kind of like plays a role in terms of how the UK does its business. So with Labour, there's been a talk about, you know, how they are going to revise that relationship. And why do you assess it? And what implication would it have for how the UK operates, you know, elsewhere in Africa, for instance?
Yeah, so I think you're going to see what happens when you when the reality of government contrasts with what you say during an election campaign. There's an expression which is that you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. So you can be optimistic and hopeful in a campaign, and then when the reality hits of being in government, maybe you aren't always able to deliver on what you want to deliver. Obviously, the Labour Party are going to take a much more positive approach to the European continent. You know, they want to build, they want to rebuild the relationships that have been damaged over years of a Conservative government, and even years before that, where the Conservatives drove the narrative about the European Union, which led to a lot of ill feeling on both sides. So maybe the Labour Party are going to be able to sort of reset those relationships. But when it comes to actually getting better trade deals, you know, the European Union are canny negotiators. They're not going to give away parts of give access to the continent, to the continent's market, without then enforcing the UK to take a degree of rules. You know, imposed from the European Union, because the European Union doesn't want to send a message to other European Union states that you can leave the EU, it's fine, because you're still going to get great trading relationships. Just with us. There has to be a consequence to leaving the partnership. You can't get all the good side of things, but not have to deal with any of the more challenging side of things, like freedom of movement, which is certainly a challenge for the continent. So, you know, so we have to see how a more positive, friendly approach can actually lead to any tangible differences. But you know, I don't think it's certainly not a sure thing that that's going to be successful. And what does that mean for Africa? I think the EU are probably more proactive than the UK when it comes to projects in Africa. They seem to be striking a better balance at both publicly, you know, stating what their aspirations are for the governments of certain African countries and for human rights, while also still doing business, you know, for want of a better phrase, with these governments. So I think that you know, you see the EU on the ground in a lot of places, and the EU are very good at putting their flag on things. So, you know, so you see when a project's been delivered by the European Union, and that's that goodwill. But I still think that, you know, I still think that Western countries, and that includes EU countries, you know, are still stuck in an old-fashioned view of the continent. And so until they've rectified that, they're never going to really maximize the opportunity that this continent holds.
I agree with you. I'm going to come to the last question, which I'm going to, it's going to be more like for you to project. But before then, what are UK's strategic interest in Africa? What do you think it is? And how can there be a mutually beneficial relationship between the UK and African countries?
Yeah, so the Labour Party's, they're staking their electoral future on getting economic growth, fixing UK public services, and on tackling small boats and getting immigration numbers down. That, you know, those are going to be the three things that are going to count when it comes to the next election. And as you said at the start of the programme, yes, the Labour Party won a big majority, but it's a very it's a very broad but a very shallow majority. What that means is, yes, they won a lot of seats. They, you know, they've got a lot of MPs, but lots of those MPs were elected with 10, with 100 or certainly less than 1,000 majorities, which means that these seats could shift very easily back to being Conservative seats in the next election, particularly if Reform, the party on the right of UK politics, don't do as well in the next election as they did in this election, which really split the vote. So Labour have to deliver economic growth, they have to sort out public services, and they have to tackle immigration. Now, the continent offers solutions to all of those problems. As I said before, you know, the future of economic growth, global economic growth, is in Africa. You know, 70% of the continent are under the age of 13. The median age on the continent is 20. If the UK can activate those populations to stimulate UK economic growth and global economic growth through the investments that we were talking about in infrastructure, in skills, in training, and get our businesses outsourcing to Africa, then we're going to see the economic benefits in the UK and on the continent. So that's one thing. But also, you know, like obviously the Rwandan migration partnership is no longer UK government policy, but that shouldn't cover up the fact that the UK are going to have to work with countries on the continent, all across the continent, to tackle the push factors that are forcing people to, well, that people feel forced to leave their countries to make these perilous journeys. So that's the economic development piece. That is the skills and education part of the equation. But they also have to deal with the pull factors to the UK. And so they have to come up with deterrence that work and come up with a way to quickly move people back to the countries where they came from if they have no right to be in the UK. And that's only going to be through grown-up relationships and grown-up conversations with countries all across the continent. And when it comes to public services, you only have to enter an NHS hospital to see that they are staffed by immigrants. Obviously, they are staffed by British people, by British-born people as well. But immigrant labour is the backbone of the NHS, and it's the backbone of many other public services. So how can the Labour Party get a grip on overall immigration numbers while still bringing in the skilled workforces that, you know, that ensure that people are, you know, are treated well in our hospitals, that our trains run, you know, that our roads are well kept. You know, it's all thanks to immigrant labour. So we have to find a way, the UK government has to find a way of squaring the circle of lower immigration numbers, but also still getting the skilled workforce. And Africa is perhaps one of the best markets to attract that labour, to come and fill those jobs. So, you know, the continent, I think, is integral to Labour delivering their promises. But we'll see whether they understand this.
Okay. Let's conclude on this note. And that is, so like, I think you've touched upon it. So if you're taxed with the... So if you're taxed with designing or crafting UK Labour's African policy, what would that look like?
So it would look like meaningful engagement with all African countries based on transactional relationship, where we align what we want in the UK with what African countries want. And that means taking a much more pragmatic, less judgmental, less values-based approach to our foreign policy. We have to fight the temptation, the British government has to fight the temptation to give in and give undue power and influence to a minority of lobby groups, or political lobby groups, who some of these human rights organisations are. It's not saying that they've got important roles in the world, for sure, but they shouldn't dictate UK foreign policy, and they shouldn't dictate anyone's foreign policy. So the UK government has to decide whether they want to approach it through the human rights NGO lens, or whether they want to approach it through a pragmatic economic lens, where we raise up African countries through meaningful, real investment, both in unlocking the human capital and also the infrastructure on the continent. Whether we deliver those relationships in a way which benefits both the continent and the UK. That's going to be how we decide the future of our relationship and whether we can make it work for the UK government. So if I was designing it, I would say we have to have more feet on the ground in Africa. We have to have African ministers empowered to actually, you know, go out there and build these relationships on the continent. We have to have trips from serious UK politicians to the continent where they meet with serious people and they have substantive discussions that then lead on to actual deals being done. We have to roll out the red carpet each and every time an African leader comes to the UK. It is shameful that when an African leader comes to the UK, they are not automatically given a meeting with the UK Prime Minister. That's got to change because that sends exactly the wrong message. And that's left a gap which is being filled by other leaders outside of the West who are treating African leaders with respect that they deserve. So it's like it's getting both the optics and the delivery right so that we are showing the respect to the African leaders that we should show whilst also backing up our warm words about development with real money delivered by real British businesses who are encouraged to invest in the continent by a British government that is, you know, that is getting them on planes, getting them to the continent for serious discussions on investment that leads to tangible deals being done.
Wow. Thank you very much, Harry, for your very, very rich, bold and innovative, solutions and critical insight. Really, I really appreciate this. And thank you once again for honoring our invitation. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you once again for tuning in to another explosive and exciting episode on the UK Labour-led government's African policy and what that will look like. Join me again to thank our guest, Harry Bonds, for his rich insight into the subject. Implore you to join me next time for more exciting episodes. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you soon.